Hi, I'm Henry Kautz. I'm the Division Director for Information and Intelligence Systems at the National Science Foundation. And I'm very delighted to introduce the first speaker in our distinguished lecture series for this year. Professor Moshe Vardeh is a university professor and George Distinguished Service Professor in Computer Science, Engineering, and also Director of the Ken Kennedy Institute for Information Technology, all at Rice University. He is a leading researcher in theory and artificial intelligence, the author of over 600 papers and 2 books. And he holds 7 honorary doctorates. I only have one doctorate that I actually had to work for, so I'm going to have to find the secret to getting all of these honorary doctorates. He also is the senior editor of the communications of the ACM. And meaning senior editor, meaning he has finally taken off the yoke a little while ago after doing a really Herculean job of turning the communications from kind of a ho-hum professional magazine into a really exciting and important journal. So with that, I'll turn it over to Moshe.
Thank you, Henry, and thank you all for joining us to this lecture today. I think it is probably true we are living through the most significant event of our lifetime. And I grew up in the Middle East, I went to several wars. I don't think we went to anything like this since essentially World War II in terms of impact and significance. And whenever you go to something like this, there will be the before and after, and we need to think about what did we learn, what, how should we change the society. And the lens that I want to focus on today is efficiency versus resilience. I was asked to give a quick self-introduction. So here it is in a nutshell. I grew up in a kibbutz in Israel. You can see it's a very bucolic, it was a great place to grow up. At age 10, I was given 10 volumes called The Young Technologist, and I devoured them, and it changed my path from the rabbinical path. I'm coming from a family of about 10 generations of rabbis, and I'm the black sheep, and I went became a scientist instead. I was a real nerd until about 15 years ago, when ACM asked me to lead the study called the Software Offshoring Study. And it was the first time that I took a serious look at also kind of societal angle of computing. And then no good deed goes unpunished, and I became editor-in-chief of CACM. And in particular, in the beginning of the decade, I started thinking very hard and spending a lot of my time since thinking about computing and society, which I think as a community, we have not done enough. And that's a whole other talk, of course. So there's no doubt that we are living through a crisis, but it's really not just one crisis, but it's a conflation of several crises on top of each other. First, it's a public health crisis. You know, we look at this dashboard every day. You know, this is a dashboard for a few months ago. By now we are at 200,000 deaths, and there's no sign that this is going to stop anytime soon. Of course, this has caused a deep economic crisis. This picture I find horrifying. You may think it's a parking lot at Disneyland, but it is people waiting in their cars for a food bank. So people can't get, they just don't have food at home. They have to go to the food bank to eat, and they're waiting hours at the food bank, at the line, to get access to food. So this is the economic crisis. Oil prices are way down. Now, for most of you, may seem this is sound like good news, but when I'm in Texas, oil prices down means huge economic hit. But for all of us, if oil prices are down, then there are much less incentives to do anything about energy, and I'll come back to energy at the very end. So if we want green energy, we can't have too cheap oil. And of course, it's also no secret that we are living through a social crisis. We had deep inequities in our society for a long time, and they have somehow there's heightened sensitivity and less tolerant to them. And as a society, we are dealing with this, how do we address these inequities? deep inequity, these systemic inequities. And also, it's no secret, whatever is your political allegiance, this is going to be the most turbulent elections, at least in my lifetime, that I think we have in this country. So we have like five crises combined into one crisis. And one thing we discovered, there was a magic phrase. I want to go back to a phrase that we don't hear much, but I think there was a phrase that we're hearing. This is for March. And everybody talk about flattening the curve. And I went back to one of the blogs that talk about flattening the curve. And all epidemic in some sense go up and then they go down. And they go down at some point because after some amount of cases and death, you do reach what we call now herd immunity. And the argument was made that we need to flatten the curve. We need to slow down and we can't have too many people sick at the same time. And why is that? Because we have limited capacity in the hospitals to deal with it. Now here, article from April 22. Nurses are wearing garbage bags as they battle coronavirus. It's like something out of Twilight Zone. So we suddenly learn about new acronyms, PPE, personal protective equipment, and we just do not have enough PPEs in this country. And as we'll see, PPEs is not the only thing that we did not have. But we discovered suddenly the systemic shortages, and that inspired William Galston, who is from the Brookings Institute, to write an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in March. And he wrote, the title was, "Efficiency is not the only economic virtue." And he wrote, "What if the relentless pursuit of efficiency, which has dominated American business thinking for decades, has made the global economic system more vulnerable to shocks?" And he wrote, "Efficiency comes through the optimal adaptation to an existing environment, while resilience requires the capacity to adapt to disruptive changes in the environment. Resilience, dictionary definition, the ability to recover readily from illness, depression, adversity, or the like." And I was just really truly inspired by this column. I'm not always inspired what I read in the Wall Street Journal, but this I find quite inspiring and kind of eye-opening. And I really would like to, that's what I'd like to spend the rest of the hour thinking about, this tension between resilience and efficiency. And I will look both at computer science and in economics. Now, Galston was not the only one. He just put it very nicely in terms of efficiency versus resilience. But Tom Friedman, the prophet of globalization, the high priest of globalization, wrote in May of this year, "Greed and globalization set us up for disaster. Over the past 20 years, we've been steadily removing man-made and natural buffers, redundancy, regulation, and norms that provide resilience and protection when big system, be it ecological, geopolitical, or financial, gets stressed. We have been recklessly removing these buffers out of an obsession with short-term efficiency and growth, or without thinking at all." So essentially the same point, the trade-off between efficiency and resilience. And for some reason now my screen is stuck. Okay. It turns out that this point, once I start doing research, it's not new that this has been known for quite a while. The earliest reference that I found, but I'm always finding new things. And if you have new insight to give me after the talk, feel free to reach out to me. An article from 1975 on the inefficiency of being efficient. And again, makes this point, I'll just read the one sentence that highlighted. "Another facet of decision-making is the narrowness with which problems are defined and the equally narrow range of alternatives sought for solution." So if you focus only on efficiency, then you're going to ignore many other consequences and many other facets of the problem. And you're only to come with very narrow range of possible solutions. So let's take an example. So I remember when just-in-time manufacturing was really hot. What is just-in-time manufacturing? So I remember it from, I think, from the 80s or 90s, became hot. And the observation was that keeping an inventory is very expensive. Why? Well, first you pay for parts and sit in a warehouse and do nothing. So this is money, this is non-productive money. And you need a warehouse and you need to maintain the warehouse. All of this is expensive, very inefficient. So the idea of just-in-time manufacturing was, let's have the parts arrive just in time when they are needed. And some companies, Dell actually was, when it was a PC maker, became famous, not so much for technical innovation, but for manufacturing efficiency and being the lowest cost margin manufacturer of personal computers. Now, of course, just-in-time manufacturing assume best case logistics. It assumed that the system, everything works smoothly and the parts arrive just in time when they are needed. But this results in a very brittle system. There is no resilience for disruptions. And we all saw it again early this year. This is a picture from Costco, from the paper supply section of Costco. And even Wall Street Journal, why there are still not enough paper towels? And the answer is lean manufacturing. Lean manufacturing is the same as just-in-time manufacturing. And a decades-long effort to eke out more profit by keeping inventory low left many manufacturers unprepared with COVID-19 struck. And production is unlikely to ramp up significantly anytime soon. So the quest for efficiency came at the expense of resilience. Now I want to look at other kind of aspects of the economy that we emphasize efficiency at the expense of resilience. So even Wall Street, where risk management is really the name of the business for many of Wall Street, especially in trading, Wall Street essentially almost went belly up in 2008, and the government had to step in to save even Wall Street. And it's not because they did not do risk management. They did risk management. And there was a formula called value at risk. And you measure you want to know that with certain probability, maybe 99%, you will not lose more than, let's say, $100 million. And you think you can absorb the loss of $100 million. And people develop rich mathematical theory. This is a financial mathematician, David Lee, develop a formula called Gaussian copula function. Of course, you can see that we can spend the next hour talking about this formula, which I won't. But it turned out later, this formula dealt with normal conditions. And it led to supreme efficiency for normal conditions. What it did not deal with is the 1% black swan event. And that 1% that happened almost brought Lehman Brothers down. And again, only other firm did not come down is because of massive government interaction. So again, they did not really think of resilience, and I'll come back to financial resilience as an example later on. You know, it's interesting to think about resilience versus efficiency in governance. We know that democracy is very inefficient, and yet Winston Churchill wrote about it. Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woo. No one pretended democracy is perfect or all wise. Indeed, it has been said democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. So we can look now at the Congress and the paralysis. We can see that democracy is very inefficient. Generally, it is more resilient than other forms of government because there is more distributed and shared decision-making. Of course, in the face of a pandemic, this is the one case where cacophonic democracy may not be very resilient. We have not dealt well with COVID-19, partly because of our countries that can have more central decision making have been able to deal with it more efficiently than we did and brought more resilience. So food for thoughts about governance. Remember the picture we saw of people waiting in line for food bags. This could have been foreseen. 2016, I was studying then, I was looking at automation and labor, and I came across this data on precariousness. Here are two articles from that came up or published in May 2016. One, nearly half of Americans would have trouble finding $400 to pay for an emergency. So if your brakes broke in the car and it costs about $400 to fix them, almost 47% of Americans did not have $400 spare to fix the broken brakes. If you raise it to a broken transmission, which will be $1,000, 2/3 of Americans will have trouble dealing with it. So people living really, really on the edge. And that's why we saw what happened with food banks. And Adam Serwer wrote in the Atlantic in June of this year, it didn't have to be like this. The desperation of US working in the aftermath of the coronavirus was a product of a series of policy decisions and missed opportunities. We knew that we have a society with the majority living on the edge, and we just accepted it in the name of efficiency. So I want to go to look at how does nature deal with this dilemma, or this not dilemma, but tension between efficiency and resilience. And in 2016, CACM, I was editor-in-chief, and we published an article, Sex as an Algorithm. It was a serious article about the theory of evolution under the lens of computation. We had a bit of a challenge on what should be the proper cover illustration for such an article. And in a bit of humor, we put pink cover, and half the people thought that, most people thought it was funny, but some people got deeply offended. So I had to fall on my sword and apologize. But the article is a serious article. And what does it look at? This was by Livnat and Papadimitriou. And they asked the following question. If you are studying algorithms, search algorithms, we know that simulated annealing, which is really based on just mutations, is generally computationally superior to genetic algorithm that also have mutation, but also cause breeding between chromosomes. People have thought that the genetic algorithm would be superior, but it turns out simulated annealing, which is just mutations, is actually better. So you can ask, why has nature chosen for animals sexual reproduction as almost the exclusive reproduction mechanism? There are always kind of corner cases and exceptions that people jump and tell me about. But generally speaking, animals produce sexually. But you can think of reproduction as a search for a better and better adaptation to nature. And why is sex being used? Why not just mutation? And again, if you're bacteriologist, you tell me there are also sideways chromosomal transfer, and let's not go into that, which in some sense, there's something common there to sexual reproduction. But Livnat and Papadimitriou came up to me with a very insightful answer. And the answer is that efficiency is not, in this case, they look at the approximating the optimum solution. Efficiency is not the only consideration. And what sexual reproduction does, it creates greater genetic diversity. And that means that it optimizes not at the level of the individual organism, but it optimizes for the species. The species is more resilient because there's more diversity. And when the environment changes, some individuals will not adapt, but others will have easier time adapting. So the species with greater diversity is more resilient, even if there is a cost of in efficiency. So there is a trade-off between efficiency and resilience. In fact, both can be thought of optimization, but efficiency, maybe we can think of it as more focused in the short term, and resilience is in the long term. Now, ultimately nature prefers, because it has a long time to do evolution, right? We are over 4 billion years here on Earth alone, and the species that were not resilient are not here anymore. The dinosaur, the T-Rex, was an incredibly efficient hunting machine, killing machine, but it was not resilient, so it is gone. So what the species that survive are the resilient species, not necessarily the efficient species. So now I want to first go back, look at computer science. So the art of computer programming is closest as we have to the Bible of computer science. Okay, and Don Knuth is the patron saint of computer science. And he invented the area called analysis of algorithm. So what is analysis of algorithm? Well, here it's from Wikipedia. In computer science, the analysis of algorithm is the process of finding the computational complexity of algorithm, the amount of time, storage, or the other resources needed to execute them. So traditionally in computer science, analysis of algorithm is only exclusively about efficiency. And you can go through the volumes of the art of computer programming, and like volume 4 is now, I think there are 6 sub-volumes. The latest one, I think, is on satisfiability, and it's all about efficiency. So let's look at sorting algorithm, kind of the one of the most classic algorithm that we teach and we study and we analyze complexity. So we talk about bubble sort, which is quadratic in the worst case and on the average as well. Merge sort is worst case is n log n, so good sorting algorithm. Quick sort, quadratic in the worst case, but in the average case, it's also n log n and considered to be one of the best sorting algorithm. In CSM in 2013, David Askley asked, what about robustness of sorting? Suppose that you have like a sorting gate or sorting algorithm where the comparators, maybe on 10%, they make an error and they give you a random answer. And this is kind of in the spirit of going back all the way to von Neumann, which I will mention again later in the future. You have some unreliable components. So what happened? He said, he ran some simulation. Well, on 10% of the comparisons, the answer was random. You flip a coin. And then he looked at the outcome. And the question was how close it is to sorting. And there are ways you can measure it. For example, how many pairs are out of order. And what he discovered was that bubble sort was robust. It produces pretty well-sorted lists, even with errors. But merge sort and quick sort were not robust. And why was quick bubble sort robust? Because of course it does many more comparisons than are really needed. We need only n log n comparisons, and bubble sort does quadratic number of comparison. And because the errors are random, bubble sort will end up being much more robust. So we always think of bubble sort as the example of the algorithm not to use, but it might be the right algorithm in the proper context because it is more robust, something that typically it's not what we teach in computer science, and we should. Let me go to a more modern example. So PageRank was the algorithm that Larry Page invented to sort the result of a web search. And you may remember the days before Google, where you had the search engine that did not have such very good ranking mechanisms. And you got all kind of garbage kind of links near the very top. And then a Google search engine came and it was magic. You got just the right answers near the very top. And the idea was to look at the underlying graph, look at the links, and the more links, the more page linked to one page, the more important it is. And ultimately this goes back to computing eigenvalue and taking random walks on Markov chain, but it gives us a way to get the best results near the very, very top. But very quickly people discovered they can change the answer by putting fake links. And this became a whole industry, search engine optimization. How to add links to move your web page, your page you open in your restaurant, you move your web page to move to the top, how to do that. So it turned out that PageRank was not resilient. And in fact, first of all, the patent has expired, but also, if you go to Google today and ask them what do they use, they can tell you. I tried Google to publish an article on search quality. And they said, we can't, it's a trade secret. As soon as we tell you how we rank the result, people will game it. So in fact, the way now to keep the algorithm robust is by keeping it secret, because otherwise people can game it. So this is an example of an algorithm that was not robust. In effect, today, machine learning is a whole area of adversarial machine learning that deals specifically with this robustness issue. But I'm a theoretician, so here is, let's take a very classical concept. There's concept of pack learning, probably approximately correct, introduced by Valiant in 1986, but it was based on a concept introduced by Stockmeyer in 83, a randomized algorithm that computes function approximately. And what you want is to have a parameter of confidence and parameter for error. And you want to make sure that the error is less than, the relative error is less than epsilon with high confidence, with confidence at least delta, maybe 99%. But there's actually was an omission in Stockmeyer's definition, in my opinion. And the omission was, what happens in the tail event? What happened in probability one minus delta? In the 1% that you allow yourself to be in error? And the answer is, the error could be so large that it will tilt the expectation. So in 2006, my collaborator Chakraborty and Mill and I looked at this, and we defined the notion of strong pack, S-pack, where in addition, we want the expectation to be correct. The answer should be correct in expectation, and you also have the probably approximately correct. And we showed that you can design an algorithm that would not be only probably approximately correct, but also strongly probably approximately correct, and that gives you resilience because you have to worry about this tail event. Remember the value at risk formula that did not account for tail events. We want to make sure that we account also for tail events. I want to give now to look at this lens again of efficiency and resilience and bring other aspects of computing that I think should fall into this. And one is a concept that I don't think we talk enough about, and this is friction. In 2013, I wrote about this topic, and I wrote, our discipline is dedicated to reducing friction. Latency must be eliminated. Bandwidth must increase. Ubiquity should be universal. Our goal is to reduce the friction of computing communication as much as possible. I think that's a, it's an abstraction, and you can find, of course, a counterexample, but I think it's a fair summary of how our discipline think of friction, whatever friction is. I haven't defined friction. But take Facebook, for example. Mark Zuckerberg defined the goal, the motto of Facebook was frictionless sharing. And this sounds good. Sharing is good. And therefore, frictionless sharing should be good. But we now know that the utopia of frictionless sharing leads to filter bubble, fake news, and extreme content. So frictionless sharing is not a good thing. Let's look at another example about friction. So 2010. We had a flash crash. The stock market crashed 600 points in 5 minutes. How did it happen? Well, we now understand it was caused by algorithmic trading or high frequency trading. That was the cause of the crash. Now, it turns out that proponent of high frequency trading said this is good. The high frequency trading is good. It makes the market more liquid. But people who, you know, Thomas Petrofi, who was one of the pioneers of high frequency trading, he said, the drive for speed has no social value. It's all about money. And yet we have really not tried to regulate friction into trading. The SEC could have said there should be a minimum, there should be a mandatory time delay for trading, but we still have high frequency trading and we have a very at-risk financial system. Let's go into the social arena. An article from 2019, Jenna Birch writes, why is it so hard to turn a Tinder date into a relationship? And she writes, despite the swarms of matches over the years, I've never had an update turn into actual relationship. This is anecdotal, but people have studied this, sociologists have studied this, and they found that couples that meet online are much more likely to split within 1 year. And it doesn't take much to understand why it's happening. I mean, Tinder requires very little investment. You just swipe left or swipe right or swipe left. Easy come, easy goes. So because the both party have a sense of it was not much of investment. So therefore you invest, if you don't invest a lot, you don't expect a lot. So you swipe, but it doesn't turn into a date, but not into a relationship. So imagine I go to in just down the hall, I go to our mechanical engineering department and ask the mechanical engineer, I said, how about removing all friction? And they would say, no, this is insane to remove all friction. If you think of a mechanical system, there are some places where we want friction and some places where we don't want friction. So Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, wrote, getting angry is easy, but getting angry for the right reason, at the right person, at the right amount, at the right time, this is hard. So again, eliminating friction doesn't make any sense. We don't function everywhere, but putting the right amount of friction in the right place, in the right time, this is hard. And we have not put the thought of where to put friction properly in computing. Where should we have friction full and where should we have friction less computing? Let me take another aspect of, I think, of this whole resilience versus efficiency. And I want to talk about security. So I had a discussion with a colleague of mine who is a fairly well-known security researcher. And we had some disagreement and he wrote to me an email explaining, this is how we do security research. This is verbatim quote from his email. First, somebody built a thing and it is super useful. Then eventually someone else comes along and finds a vulnerability. Then security becomes a part of an engineering process. Just like we need to make sure our code does not have bugs that makes it crash, we also need to make sure that our code does not have bugs that can be exploited for bad purposes. Turn the crank for enough years and eventually security gets better. So security comes last, not at the beginning. And in fact, we've seen it with Zoom. As the whole world moved to Zoom, I'll come back to that point, security was something that was added later. Security was not something that put on the first floor. Security, we put something we put on the top floor. So here we are. You know, we have a computer age, about 75 years. We can look at the Turing Awards as the milestone for our accomplishments in computing. So we can look at the list of Turing Awards and we see, okay, how many Turing Awards were given in cybersecurity? As far as I can see, none. We've given three Turing Awards in cryptography. Three Turing Awards in cryptography. RSA, Blum, and Mikali, Goldwasser Mikali, they're all in cryptography, but nothing in cybersecurity. Why? Because we still really don't have solid foundation how to build secure information systems. And now we need to think, it's not just about compromised security, it's about vital infrastructure. Our communication infrastructure is vital, but it's not just our communication and computing infrastructure, it's our power infrastructure, it's our financial infrastructure. So our community somehow marches along without realizing that we have given up in some aspect of resilience and we're living over in a very fragile world these days. And I'll come back to that. And partly I would argue did come from a philosophy that our community tended to have, not everybody, but there's clearly a deep streak of cyber libertarianism. So if we compare cybersecurity to car travel safety, you know, the Ford Model T went off the manufacturing line in 1908. For about 100 years now, we've been trying to reduce fatalities, and we've done actually a very good job in reducing fatalities. We institutionalize it. We have the National Transportation Safety Board, all about automobile safety. Who is responsible for cybersecurity? Well, it's distributed. It's NIST, some NSA, some here, some there. It's not clear, there's no one agency to regulate cyber security. And that's partly because we hate regulation. This is in the tech community, people keep telling you regulation stifles innovation. And so just don't talk to us about regulation. But when it comes to cybersecurity, it's unlikely that this issue will be addressed without government regulation. So we need to really take security seriously and regulation seriously. So this was the computer science, and let's go back to economic efficiency. So it's become very clear that because we pursued efficiency so enthusiastically that we did not develop the robustness that we need to deal with the pandemic. And a simple example is the CDC budget cut in February of this year. And President Trump defended it by saying, we can hire more doctors when we need them, which is true. We can hire more doctors when we need them, but by the time we need them, we are in the middle of a crisis. And so we end up by efficiency giving up resilience. So I went to Investopedia to learn a little more about economics. So what is economic efficiency? This is the Investopedia definition. Goods and factor of production are distributed or allocated to the most valuable use, and waste is minimized. This is efficiency. And free market advocates, this is again from Investopedia, free market advocates argue that through individual self-interest and freedom of production as well as consumption, economic efficiency is achieved and the best interest of society as a whole are fulfilled. So everybody would follow their self-interest, everybody will optimize for themselves, and the result will be efficiency and optimality. Wow. So the free market will give us both efficiency and optimality. But I want to question, does efficiency guarantee optimality? So you have to go and learn a little bit about economics and the basic theorems in microeconomics, and the basic theorem is called the first welfare theorem. And the first welfare theorem is about efficiency. It basically said that under certain technical assumptions, the market will converge towards a competitive Pareto optimal equilibrium. So this is efficiency. Now this gives us optimality. How well does an equilibrium serve the best interests of society? So this is a question that was not well studied by economists. So computer scientists got into to study this. And this study of efficiency versus optimality was started by Kotsopias and Pavlimitriou in 1999. They were inspired when we developed, like for example, online algorithm. We want to know how well does an online algorithm perform as opposed to the best offline algorithm. And so we studied this online ratio. And they say, why don't we apply the same to the study of equilibria? And they say, what is the ratio between the worst possible Nash equilibrium and the social optimum? So this is in games where everyone has utility. So the social optimum is the best that society collectively can do. And this was called later the price of anarchy. And what they show is the price of anarchy can be arbitrarily high depending on the complexity of the system. So that means that what the belief that the free market will give us efficiency and optimality, this is completely misguided. If you have efficiency, there's no guarantee of optimality. So efficiency does not guarantee that the best interests of society as a whole are fulfilled. But the problem goes deeper. Later on, a few years later, Pavlimitriou with Doskalakis and Goldberg asked, how long will it take to converge to an equilibrium? And the assumption is that it's a free market, so the only way we converge to equilibria is by a sequence of local improvement. So one merchant realizes that she can raise the price a little bit. And one provider realized that they can make a little more of the commodity. So it's a sequence of local improvement. It's really analogous to a local search, local steps. You gradually converge. And they prove a technical result. They prove that finding Nash equilibrium is PPAD complete. But what it means in simple words, that it may take a very, very long time of small steps to converge to an equilibrium. But this means that if it takes so long, the world will change during that time because things will change. Price will change, supply will change, demand will change. So the answer is we are never at an equilibrium. So this whole focus, and this is actually known by some economists, that it takes too long to convert. So even though much of economy based on equilibrium theory, we are never in an equilibrium. And even if we get to an equilibrium, it's not optimal. So this really makes some of what the attitude towards free market, they're really fundamentalist ideas that bears no relationship to reality. The paradigm of that was a movie in 1987, a movie called Wall Street, and Michael Douglas plays this financier, Gordon Gekko, and he gives a rousing speech. It's a famous speech, you can find it on YouTube. Greed, for the lack of better word, is good. And the argument is, this is how Adam Smith's invisible hand works. Everybody optimizes for themselves, and as at the end, society will reach optimal. But we know that this is not the case. We know that greedy algorithm gets stuck in local optima. In my opinion, right now, when it comes to cybersecurity, we are stuck in a bad equilibrium. And some systemic intervention is needed to drive us out of this local optima, local optimum in this case, because somehow the market does not appreciate enough security. You know, programs sell for features, systems sell for features, robustness, not for robustness. If you think what happened in cars, I know of one car where safety, Volvo, safety is a marketable feature. But for most other car manufacturers, they just have to meet government standards. If there is safety in cars, it's because the government stepped in and applied standards. And we don't have it when it comes to cybersecurity. We have market failure. Now, interestingly, this is now this past weekend was just the fifth anniversary of the article by Milton Friedman, who argued that the social responsibility of the corporation is to make profits. So the Wall Street Journal the New York Times is a special issue, and the headline was, greed is good except when it is bad. And they quoted, for example, Mark Benioff, who is the CEO of Salesforce, and he wrote, I did not agree with Friedman then, and the decades since have only expressed his myopia. Just look where the obsession with maximizing profit for shareholders has brought us. Terrible economic, racial, and health inequalities, the catastrophe of climate change. It's no wonder that so many young people now believe that capitalism cannot deliver the equal, inclusive, sustainable future they want. So if capitalism is going to work, it's not by myopic focus on efficiency and profits. In fact, I mean, you go back to some of the basic assumptions in economic, and there is this mythical character that economics half jokingly call homo economicus, and this is a supremely rational agent who just focus on their self-interest and just optimize their utility. And economists, I mean, there's a whole branch in between psychology and economics to study behavioral economics. People do not behave rationally. But I think a more fundamental truth was actually stated already in the 50s by Herb Simon, also a computer scientist, and he introduced the concept of satisficing, which is you settle for good enough outcome. And this is actually how most people operate. They settle for good enough outcome. It's less efficient, it's more resilient. And I was intrigued enough by that I want to see, can I turn this into a research problem? And I want to tell you, I'm going to zoom in a little bit into a technical, about three technical slides, just tell you about some work done by my PhD student, where we try to take this idea of good enough and turn it into a research problem. So my student, Suguman Banzal, became a CI fellow, thank you NSF. And she worked on discounted sum games. So you have two players who are making moves on a graph game. And in every state you get a reward, and the stream of rewards is aggregated via discounted sum. And there is a classical hero optimization problem, find a strategy for player zero that will maximize the reward against player's one strategy. And this is well known to be in polynomial time using value iteration, which is an algorithm, of course, that we know a lot also, in reinforcement learning and many other applications. You gradually optimize the values until you converge. So classical result from 1996. The question we asked ourselves, suppose in addition to the optimization problem, we also want to have on the sequence of states, we want to have what we call temporally extended goals, some constraints on a sequence of states. For example, every message sent is eventually received. And these are what we call hard constraints. So we distinguish between the hard constraints, which are these temporal goals, and the soft optimization problem. But it turns out, this was shown a few years ago, that in this case, there's no optimal strategy. There's no optimum. So the question is, what can we do then? And we decided to look at satisficing. So we look at this situation, but instead of optimizing the reward, now we are asking, there is a threshold and you want to do better than the threshold. For example, maybe this is a energy expenditures and you want to make sure you don't exceed a certain threshold or certain reward, you want to exceed it. But this, you still have hard temporal constraints. And now we're able actually to prove that there is an algorithm for integral discount factors. Again, I want to go into detail, but by giving up optimality and instead settling for good enough result, we're actually able to do more. So I think this is an interesting idea for many, probably in computer science. What about instead of doing optimization, to just do good enough satisficing and see what computational avenues it opens to us, giving up on optimality. So let's go back to COVID-19 now. What did work? Well, the internet did work. We are working from home, shopping from home, teaching from home, learning from home, giving size distinguished lectures from home. How do we do that? Well, redundancy. So if we've learned anything is that you can build reliability and resilience using redundancy. I don't know the full history of this. Clearly, when you go to Shannon error correcting gods, you use redundancy to establish resilience. For Neumann, when he talks about how to build reliable organism from unreliable cells, again, it was about redundancy. The Fed now knows if you want bank to be resilient, they have to have redundancy of capital. So we go back to value at risk. You need to have, it's beyond quantifiable. They just want to make sure they do various scenarios. And I want to make sure you have redundancy of capital. And the hero, part of the one hero for this, for the internet, is Paul Baran, who needs to be a household name, but he is not. But here is a recent description of his vision of distributed network. Baran's motivation for creating his revolutionary approach to communication networking, this is packet switching, was driven by the dominant issue of the 1960s, the Cold War, and the overhanging threat of nuclear annihilation. America's nuclear capability depend on maintaining what the strategic defense community called minimum essential communication, which was the amount of connectivity needed for the US to credibly maintain the threat of mutually assured destruction, which most observers believe was essential to deter the Soviet Union from attempting a preemptive strike. So many people always thought of mutual assured destruction as this crazy, strange, lovely idea, but it gave us very resilient communication infrastructure or internet. I can give this talk today. We can survive COVID-19 from a very indirect chain that goes back to mutually assured destruction. I find this absolutely amazing chain of event, how we got today and where we got started in the 1960s. So I want to summarize. Resilience is a fundamental but underappreciated societal need. I'm a computer scientist. I'm spending a lot of time the last few years learning about economics. I think both fields, and probably we can apply to many other fields as well, need to focus more on resilience. An important observation is that people and markets and societies are not very good at preparing for very low probability events. Okay, so take car insurance as an example. Everybody that has a car in this society has car insurance, almost everybody. Why is that? Because we are forced. I just had to renew my car registration with the state of Texas, and I had to provide proof of insurance. Otherwise, I will not get a tag registration that I can put on my car. So I'm forced to buy insurance. Now, why don't they rely on the market to do that? Because they know it's not reliable. So social action is required. So we need to think of many other aspects where we need resilience, and it will not happen without societal action to ensure resilience. Because otherwise people and market will focus on efficiency. And many people are saying that COVID-19 is just a dress rehearsal for a much bigger challenge coming down the highway for us, which is climate change. So we are all watching in horror what's happening in on the West Coast. And if you want to see a trend, then somebody did do a trend and they put the amount of wildland acres buried in millions of acres in California, Oregon, Washington, and you can see a clear linear trend. So we have a huge problem coming at us. And if you want to get really, really scared, then I suggest you read a book from about five, six years ago by Oreskes and Conway called The Collapse of Western Civilization. It's a kind of historical science fiction. It's the history of what's happening with the collapse, given, I think, from the historian in the 23rd or 24th century. And it's absolutely chilling when you read it. Of course, it's a scenario. Nobody knows exactly how things will unfold, but it's not an implausible scenario, and it's very, very scary. And I want to give, in closing, a shout out to one is very new book that just came out by Linzel and Russell called The Innovation Delusion. And they write, the vast majority of engineers will wind up maintaining existing systems, keeping them going. Thank goodness, we're overvalued than you. They argue that America has been seduced by the false charms of innovation, causing us to chase novelty and pursue disruption while neglecting maintenance and infrastructure in both the public and private sectors. We know that we have deferred investment infrastructures of trillions of dollars. We've underinvested. And they blame, I would say, I view myself as part of the tech community. In this case, it was a partnership somehow between the tech community and the financial community. And they said the innovation culture started to come into vogue with the financialization of the global economy in the 1980s before going into hyperdrive with the rise of the internet. So I lived in Palo Alto for about 15 years in the early 80s to mid 90s. And then it was really, people really thought about the place as an engine of technical innovation. And then the dot-com happened, and then Silicon Valley became the place of becoming rich instead of becoming just technical innovation. Something did change. And the other book that I think we should go back and read is actually not a new book. It's a book, it's about 25-year-old book. It's a book by Ulrich Beck, a German sociologist, called The Risk Society. And he basically argues that modern society is actually, globally, is very precarious. If you look at this, 2 years after that book came out, Chernobyl happened. And again, Chernobyl couldn't have ended up much, much worse. You know, again, we lucked out with Fukushima could have been much, much worse. And he argued that as a society, we are not ready for this large scale threat. In a recent article by Adam Tooze in Foreign Policy, he asked the question, so really explored by the crisis such as Chernobyl and ongoing coronavirus pandemic is how to navigate this world. And I think the buzz for the day should be resilience, resilience, resilience. And I think the National Science Foundation in particular needs to take a step back and look at their portfolio and ask how much are we investing in efficiency and how much are we investing in resilience? Because ultimately resilience is about survival. Efficiency is not. Thank you very much. Henry, you're muted.
Hi. Thank you, Moshe. Fabulous talk. We now have time for question answering. If I'm correct here, I think there's a Q&A chat, and people can type in their questions, and I'll go through them and then ask them to Moshe. So, the first one's simple. Will the slides be available? Yeah, this seminar is being recorded and will be posted, and there'll be a way to.
Yeah. And I'll share with you PDF. You can post next to the presentation. Yeah.
Great. Okay. And there's just lots of people making comments. And okay, here's one from NSF. I would love to hear your views upon whether privacy is also stuck in a local Optima, much like cybersecurity.
So I think the issue with privacy, I think both are stuck in local in local pessima, local pessima, we should call it. They're both stuck, but for different reasons, I think. Well, the common thing is somehow the market doesn't quite value it properly, but I think for different reasons. I think that security is this invisible thing. So it's just hard for, that's why if you take away the requirement for car insurance, even though most people understand that they can be financially ruined by an accident, they still will not buy insurance. And so we have to have a societal intervention, a government intervention required to have insurance. And I think that's the issue, is that somehow there are features, there is a famous, I forgot who said it, God made me chaste, but not today. You know, I see an ice cream and I know ice cream is not good for me. I'll stop eating ice cream tomorrow. I mean, this is called also by economists hyper discounting. We can get a small reward now. And even though it costs us more in the long term, we're very bad at making long term evaluation, kind of really computing properly a present value. Privacy, in some sense, it's the same, but not the same. So you can argue that people give away their data. But they give away their data partly because it is opaque how much data they give and how it's given. So the tech company knows all about us. We don't know anything about them. And who gets this data? I mean, there's a whole network of data brokers who buy and sell data, and we know nothing about it. And also, I call it the there is a famous Greek paradox, is called the sand heap paradox. If you have a heap of sand and you take one grain at a time, well, if you take a heap of sand, you take one grain, you are left with a heap of sand, everybody would say. But we all understand if you take enough grain, the heap will disappear. So this is the failure of induction. You can argue, but the reverse sand heap paradox. If I put one grain of sand on a floor, it's just one grain of sand. If I add another grain of sand, it's another grain of sand. But clearly we understand if you put enough of them, it's a heap of sand. We give our data away one grain at a time, and we have no idea what is the cumulative picture look like. And right now it's given data, collecting data from us is the big business model for some of our largest tech companies. In particular, this is definitely true for Google and Facebook. Apple actually managed to make a business model out of privacy. Okay. It's possible to do that. What happened on your iPhone says on your iPhone. I think again, it will require some kind of a government regulation to deal with the privacy issue. And it ties, in particular with social media, it ties to speech and freedom of speech and hate speech. It's a very, very thorny issue. I don't know that we'll have to slog through this to figure something out when it comes to privacy.
Okay, and let me add some questions on my own. I have sort of two related questions. So one is there's kind of a tension in your talk between optimality and robustness. So when you talk about algorithms that get stuck in local minima, it seems like that actually might be a good thing if that's a robust local minima. And then sort of related to that, have you or others are thinking about, well, I just need to change my objective function and then I can do optimization and I'll optimize for robustness. And this is just like in machine learning, you add regularization to your objective function to increase robustness of your solution.
So I think this is actually closer to what I would call another area called multi-criteria optimization. So the answer is, it's part of why I get upset, with the US News and World Report just came up with the new ranking and everybody goes agog. Of course, all the institutions that did well, such as Rice University, go agog about this ranking. But the reality is that there's no way to linear rank institutions that are very, very different, and we take different criteria, and we put magical way to aggregate them, and poof, we're in an order, and everybody is seduced by this order. But it's really a multidimensional problem. At best, you can talk about the Pareto optimal curve, and decision making should be highly individualized. What is more important to you when you come to a university? Do you care more about the social act? Do you care more about academics? Do you care more about the we have lots of trees at Rice? How important is to you to have lots of trees? And the answer is, life is about trade-offs. And the thought that you can reduce all trade-offs to waiting, many years ago when I was at IBM, we had to decide when IBM went to a crisis, and one of the people who reported to me wanted me to help him to decide how to allocate his time between doing science and doing technology. So we said, let's do this. Let's just put it into ultimately one optimization problem. And what we got was, we did the answer, and the answer was he should do either only science or only technology. And we both stared at that and we said, this is nonsensical answer, what's wrong? And the answer was, we framed it ultimately as a linear optimization problem. And therefore, the optimum was going to be an extremal point. And the reality is that life was more complicated. Life is not linear. This is my biggest bit of wisdom I can share. Life is not linear. And optimization is difficult. And yeah, you can wait. You can try to combine things. But it's not clear to me there is a principal way to combine efficient versus resilient. You need to think of the context. And the context is sometimes not just what the individual person wants, but what society does. So for individual person, it might be that doing car insurance is not efficient, and therefore they shouldn't do it. And in small probability, they'll have an accident and they'll have a huge claim, but they don't have enough money to pay for the claim, they declare bankruptcy, and that's the way they'll deal with it. So it might be for each individual, the efficient answer is do not buy car insurance. I have not done the analysis, so I'm just hypothesizing. But the society will say, no, this is actually a very bad world and people don't have car insurance. So we come up with a societal answer to this. We are facing kind of part of the same issue with climate change, where we need global cooperation. So people now think of globalization as a dirty word, but we cannot deal with climate change without some global cooperation. And for each country, it might, you know, this is a classical prisoner's dilemma. For each country, it might be efficient to defect. But globally, we understand that everybody defects, we are all screwed. So I don't think it's just simple. Let's just find a way to put the weights and convert it into one optimization problem. I think it's more complicated than that.
Thank you. Another question from the Q&A screen. Would like your thoughts on countering disinformation to block sites and sources that produce false material and even promote dangerous ideologies, or should we allow them to flow but regulate, but how?
So the problem for us is, you know, you think what has changed. So imagine that the 20 years ago, I wanted to publish some kind of a KKK, pro-KKK op-ed in the newspaper. And I submitted first to New York Times, and they don't even reply to my email. I tried the Washington Post, but they all ignore me, and I keep trying. And eventually, maybe I find some small newspaper in some small town, maybe in the South, not going to pick on anyone, and they publish my op-ed. So it was published. I had freedom of, I'm free to write this article, but the echo is going to be very small. It would just be in a small town. Now, imagine that we are taking all the newspapers of the world, we're creating one newspaper. And now this one newspaper decide what to publish and what not to publish. And on one side, what gets published in this newspaper can be read by everyone in the world. Everybody, it's translated to all the languages somehow, and everybody can read it. On the other hand, if it's not published, that means this newspaper has tremendous amount of power to decide what gets published and what doesn't get published. This is the situation we are now with, especially with Facebook. So on one hand, Facebook give a megaphone to all kind of bad information, and this is both disinformation and hateful information. On the other hand, who's going to decide what should be published and what's not to publish, especially when it comes to political speech? So this is to me right now, one of the biggest challenges is there is section 230 that says that Facebook is a platform and therefore they're not really liable for what is being published on there by third parties. It's actually questionable if they're really a platform, because their algorithm, they're actually much more. The algorithm decides what people can see, so they're not a passive platform. But whether if we take away the protection from them, suddenly they are responsible. Do we expect Facebook to make all publishing decisions? I think this is a social dilemma. I'll call it now the social dilemma of social media. And we as a society have to figure out what is the answer. And one people argue the answer is antitrust. The problem is that we have one large Facebook, and we understand why, because this is because of a Metcalfe law, the network law favor such a one, essentially one Facebook. We need to sit down and think very hard, I think, how to deal with this challenge.
Okay, and in other words, it's really hard and you don't know. None of us know yet. Yep. So here's have another NSF question here, a somewhat glib question. If whoever the next president is calls you up and says, Professor Vardy, join my scientific advisory board, what would your first action items be? So imagine you just joined OSTP.
So first of all, just because the president calls you up does not mean you have to say yes. It will depend. It will depend also which president. So, but secondly, you know, having OSTP is important, and basically understanding that the goal of the government cannot be just, even if you encourage, let's invest in AI, let's invest in quantum, let's just do technical investment. Kind of going back a little bit, we celebrated just last spring the 75th anniversary of Vannevar Bush signs the Endless Frontier article, which was around April or May of 1945, so it was 75 years. And of course, this article is ultimately the foundation, for example, of National Science Foundation. And Vannevar Bush makes the argument that basic science is good for society. Why? Because basic science will give us economic growth and will give us health and will give us national security and so on and so forth. So he calls for a major federal investment in basic science. And of course he's right, but he's not completely right, because investment in basic science, we all understand, it is necessary, but it is not sufficient. That is to say, you can have innovation, but it doesn't, even if it contribute to economic growth, doesn't necessarily contribute to shared prosperity. And if you don't have a good public health system, then you can have cutting edge cancer treatment, but still poor life expectancy because we don't do pre and postnatal care well in this country. So I think the scientific community needs to own it, that investment in R&D does not necessarily translate to societal progress. And the reason that we are all benefiting from we are all living in the generosity ultimately of the taxpayer, that creates ultimately, I think, an obligation for us, a moral obligation of science for the public good. Doesn't mean that we only do applied science. It still think basic science is a good investment, but it has to be accompanied by a set of policies that will look at the market failures and why doesn't science translate always to public good, and address not just the science part, but look at also at this, at the, we need science policies that make sure that science ultimately contributes to the public good.
I have a question from our director of science. Our field tends to tilt towards efficiency in that we look for things that we can quantify and improve upon. Computer security is an example of a field that is about low probability events. you have thoughts on how we can shift our research mindset and methods to better address the important challenges in fields like this, that is, ones that are focused on low probability events.
So I had a conversation some years ago with another SAIS AD. We talked about the situation. And I said, maybe we're not investing enough in security research. And I was told, look, I can roughly quantify how many dollars it takes to generate a paper. Because we know how much money we are investing. We know how much papers we're getting. So maybe we get, I don't know exactly, but let's say $50,000 generate another paper per year. We are somewhere in that neighborhood, okay, give or take. He said, okay, so suppose that I make enough investment to generate 1,000 more papers in computer security. Will it move the needle on a global scale in the cybersecurity of the infrastructure and the system in this country? And the answer was, and I said, you know what? That's a good question. I don't know that will change it. So again, if we want, we need to think that there has to be a whole chain. It's not enough that we have more papers published. We need to look at the whole ecosystem. Why is it? And I've been somewhat faster than I was trying to get, to me what's happening in cybersecurity, my metaphor is there is a dam, it is leaky, and we keep sticking fingers. And every time we see another hole, we stick another finger. While probably the answer was the dam was poorly built, and we need to change the boundary conditions. And the question is, and I think it requires some serious thinking. And again, it's the same way to say I don't have a good answer. But I think we need to sit down and not just think, it's not just a research problem. It's what maybe the problem may have to do with liability laws. Maybe if companies will have a higher liability in case of cybersecurity breaches, they will put more money into it. Why are they not following best practices? Many people are saying that there is body of knowledge, but companies are not following it. Why are they not following it? What is the market failure? I think, again, we need to take a broader look. It's not just about security research. It's about how do we translate it ultimately to public good.
Okay, have a question. Getting back, I guess, a more technical question of how do we actually measure resilience? So we have a system, let's say a multi-agent system, and we have these adversarial actors, these non-Gaussian type events. So you gave an example of strong pack where you're going to say, well, you want your algorithm to still have the right expectation. But sometimes if you're really in an adversarial situation, you might not be able to prove that. So what can you actually say about how do you measure, give some number to how resilient a system is?
So I think that in this case, I don't have a direct answer, but I have, I think, a clear indirect answer, which is, I think, launching some kind of a program for the study of resilience. That's exactly what I think SAIS can do. Okay, so this, I mean, some areas I don't have a very good answer, but I think we have paid for 70 years, we've paid attention to efficiency. In certain contexts, of course, we pay attention to resilience. As I said, the design of the internet is about resilience. People that do distributed system talk a lot about fault tolerance. So in certain parts of computer science, you find a lot, as in machine learning and adversarial machine learning. But I think we need to take resilience now as something that we need to study. And maybe with efficiency, we translated it mostly to a small number of answers, resource usage, and how close we are to optimal. It's not clear that in resilience we'll have, again, such small number of answers. Maybe it's a more complicated beast and will be more answers. But I think this is let's sit down and launch a SAIS program on resilience. I mean, recently, if you think about it, SAIS, I forgot the acronym, PPOP or something like that, which is a SAIS program for essentially for scalability. Or so in some sense in particular because of Moore's law or the death of Moore's law, the slowdown of Moore's law, whatever you want to call it, how do we continue to move the scalability angle? So which is again about efficiency. Let's have a program, let's have a size program about efficiency. Cross directorate, people in different fields, all the way from the theory, the same way that the theory people are studying bias, for example, algorithmic bias become now a technical field. Let's look at resilience, algorithmic resilience, systemic machine learning resilience, system resilience, multi-agent resilience. I think this, I said, I just gave one tiny example here of a research problem, but I think that we need to unleash people's creativity to study resilience.
That's actually a great idea. And I want to remind people that for the NSF people only, at 4 p.m. Eastern time today, we have an office hour with Maharshi Vardi, and there's a separate link you should receive for a different Zoom meeting for just drop in to discuss. And I know I'll be there, and I'd like to actually go into depth with him about this idea about how to shape a program. To see a few more questions. One is in your sort of wide ranging thoughts about resilience, you read a lot of economics. Have you also been looking at information from neuroscience about how the brain is resilient?
No, I think that's so the brain actually is a good example. I think that's I like this suggestion. I mean, one of the, we know, for example, this is part of biology. The brain is resilience in a sense, like brain plasticity means that you lose part of the brain and other parts take the role of that part. So there was I read a case a few years ago about this woman that always has some, she has some problem with walking and her gait. And eventually, in her 20s, they finally did an MRI. And it turned out that she lacked one hemisphere. She only had one hemisphere for the brain. And she grew up not 100% normal, but almost normal. This is just mind-blowing that you can just have half the brain and still have some problem, but by and large be functional. And generally, in fact, my understanding is, again, I'm not a biologist or an anatomist, but my understanding is part of what happened in aging, that a lot of the body has a lot of kind of spare capacity, a lot of redundancy. And as we age, we lose some of the redundancy. And therefore we lose resilience. As we age, we lose resilience because we are using spare parts. And as we lose redundancy, we lose resilience. So all of us become a bit more fragile as we get older, and part of it losing redundancy. So the body does it by redundancy and adaptability. So these are, I think, the two elements. But again, there are people who I'm sure know much more about this than me. But yes, I think biology has done a lot for resilience, even the level of the organism. And again, I think to me, the first principle of resilience is redundancy. And there are other areas of computer science. You know, we have a whole product, RAID, redundant array of independent disks, where we have redundancy as a fundamental design principle.
And I guess sort of related to this notion of redundancy and also how nature does things, you mentioned genetic algorithms. And so generally a genetic algorithm will provide many different solutions, because typically a problem will have many different Pareto optimal solutions. You could get a whole slew of those. Where the sort of the greedy approach will get you one greedy solution. So is there really just a confusion between efficiency and greed? Like that it's really like the idea it's not the need to be inefficient, maybe it's just not to keep a singular focus on a single dominating strategy.
So, you know, it will be, you know, for example, I remember when that after, because of the Y2K, there was a need to replace control boxes in the power grid. And before that, there was gazillion different control boxes because it's organically different companies put different control boxes. And one of the things that happened is that became the control plane, kind of the power grid became much more of a monoculture. And because of that, it became much less resilient. It became much more vulnerable because it means you only need to know how to attack a very small number of type of control units. So again, when you focus on the best, you end up, this is, remember, on the inefficiency of being efficient. You narrow the set of solutions. And many dark cases where we need to have, just the answer would be to have diversity of solution. In fact, one of the, when we talk about the argument why we need in society to promote diversity, there are really two arguments to decide. One is the diversity is, I would say, one argument is a social justice argument. Why you should have diversity is it's just a social justice to be fairer to more people. But there's always the other side, the business argument for diversity, which is more diversity creates more perspectives, and more perspective leads to better decision making. And you know, many, we need to think about it again. Do we want systems that are just monolithic, one protocol, or many different implementation, or different optimization criteria? I'm trying here to not come up with answers, but to open the door to asking more questions.
Okay, I'd like to inject, I hope you still are going strong. We have about 5 more minutes. This has been a really exciting conversation. I'd like to inject one of my own questions again. So during this pandemic, I decided to do some programming and just learn some modern programming. So I learned JavaScript programming and created some, you know, some demos and things, and then was greatly discovering TypeScript, which attempts to put some structure on top of JavaScript. But what struck me is JavaScript, like Python, is essentially a zero security language. You cannot write secure code because at runtime, any function you call can go in and start mucking around with sort of other with other objects and functions. And I just don't see how you could have any secure guarantees about a program written in either a language. And yet they've really taken off because there's very low friction. And then they're trying to bolt on security with things like TypeScript, but it's just after the fact and really not effective. Has the programming language community kind of let us down in the sense that, you know, there's all these programming languages, which you can, it's easier to write correct programs, but they've not caught on because, to the extent that the Python and TypeScript have caught on, because there's just a little bit more friction there. So do we need to rethink programming languages to get both the frictionless, near frictionless, but also get something that you can actually prove your code is right?
So, you know, remember this email quote. It's really a verbatim quote from, even the typos are verbatim from that email from this nameless colleague. That security is always kind of an afterthought. And I remember hearing an interview many years ago with an architect who designed high-rise building. And he said the following metaphor. He said, imagine that you have a 100-story tower. You already design it. And then they ask you to add one more floor. They want it to be 101. So you think, okay, I've already had this design for 100 stories. All I have to do is add one more at the top. He said, this is the wrong way to think about it. You have to think that the one floor that you add is at the very bottom. So you have to take your 100 stories and lift them and stick one floor at the bottom. So that's really, but if by the time you built a system, and I would say now let's add security, it's too late. And I think, I wouldn't blame just the PL people. I think as a community, we has just not taken security seriously enough. We didn't start with first do no harm. This should be, I think, like we should have some kind of first do no harm. First respect security and privacy. Now let's talk about what feature you want to add in. We didn't do it. We assume you can add them all. Look, these are design flaws. I think the internet is one of the biggest things since sliced bread, but we basically say we'll put security at the application level. Doesn't work, we know that now. I mean, you look at Intel, discover that there are security flaws and it's micro architecture. People discover now with all these attacks, side channel attacks that are very at the very, very core because they have focused on efficiency. And so we need to start thinking from how do we build secure systems? And we need to put security, as I said, we need to say security and privacy first. Let's build nothing unless you told me how you're going to, from day one, to think about security and privacy. Then you start adding other features because, and the same thing, if you just want to make the programming easy and security will come by a higher level or put on top of it, it's not going to work.
And I said, I wish we had a lot more time because I think that's exactly right. But the question is, how do we, I guess, make that happen? Because we, as academics, we can proclaim that and we can tell our students to do it. But of course, there's this big commercial world out there. And so there might need to be some sticks as well as carrots involved.
Look, part of the cyber libertarian attitude, look at every computing product that you use and look at the license and look at the disclaimer of liability in the license. And you'll never drive a car that will have the same disclaimer of liability. When it comes to cars, it's a personal product. And it used to be, the presumption was buyer beware, caveat emptor, but we, throughout a sequence of cases and legislation and one step at a time, we understand that we live today in such a technologically sophisticated society. You cannot tell people, check your own, you buy a car, check, make sure that it is safe. No, you buy a new car at least, used car is a different matter, but at least a new car, there is strict liability of the manufacturer. But when it comes to computing technology, somehow we carved an exception. No, we are not responsible. Why is that? Why should we be held to a weaker standard than people who make a vacuum cleaner? They have more liability than people who make today product that run this world. Okay. And so I would think the stick would be, let's start with liability laws. Why should we have an exception? Why are we so privileged to have this exception that no other industry has?
That's a great comment. We've run out of time. This has been fabulous. I you have many comments in the Q&A that just simply saying great job. I want to read one that really calls out something special about your talk. It says, you have to be a boss to do a whole size distinguished lecture in Comic Sans font bordered by vintage Tetris. So I said, we appreciate that. And you know, especially those of us who really like Comic Sans and have, you know, we've been bullied over the years that it's a terrible font, but it's a really nice readable font.
Comic Sans, I get, there are people who love it, there are people who hate it. To me, it looks personable.
Exactly. Okay, so I'll see you again at 4 o'clock. And thank you. If you enjoyed this webinar, please stay tuned for our webinar series. Next webinar will be Krista Savor from Microsoft, who will be talking to us about quantum. She leads a quantum computing group where they're actually building quantum computers at Microsoft. And then we'll have a whole series of monthly speakers all online for your viewing pleasure in the coming months. Take care, everyone. Stay safe.
Could I just do me a favor? If somebody can copy the chat and send me the chat.
Will do.
Okay. See you this afternoon.